There we go. Can astronomers identify the creator? That's the topic for tonight. And I want to first of all make a major concession that science cannot prove the biblical God. There is no absolute proof for the existence of God. Mind you, I reminded my wife on the day we were married 29 years ago that I was marrying her without absolute proof of her existence. All I had was a high probability of her existence. But I can tell you now that we've been married 29 years, the probability for her existence is considerably higher than it was the day that we got married. But even on the day we got married, I considered it was adequate, that the evidence was adequate for me to commit the rest of my life to her. Science cannot prove in any absolute sense that God exists because it can't prove anything in any absolute sense. But it can establish the existence of God plus or minus a measurable uncertainty, which raises two questions for the scientists. Is the uncertainty factor shrinking or growing as we learn more and more about the universe? Is the uncertainty factor small enough to eliminate some or all of the alternative explanations for the universe? Now, I got interested in astronomy when I was 7 years of age. The first book I read in astronomy was a book by Sir Fred Hoyle, of whom you've already heard. He was a lifelong pantheist, but he wrote a book about cosmology in the early 1950s, and he talked about the cosmology of the different holy books and religions of the world. And when he got to the Bible, he made the statement that the Bible, of all the world's religious texts, has more cosmology in it than any other, by more than a factor of 10. And he said, what we see in the Bible is amazing in its content. Now, he didn't like what the Bible had to say, but he did admit that it was loaded with cosmology, and its content, indeed, was amazing. Well, let me just summarize for you a few of the things the Bible says about the origin and structure of the universe. As many of you are probably well aware, starting from the first verse of the Bible, there's the emphatic biblical statement that the universe came from nothing, that there was an actual beginning to matter, energy, space, and time. Hebrews 11:3 makes the point that the universe that we can detect was made from that which we cannot detect. So this is a unique biblical statement to the effect that there's this actual beginning to space and time when the universe was created. And the Bible says even more about the continual expansion of the universe. That it continuously expands from this creation event and expands under constant physics. Jeremiah 33:25, the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. One of many passages that talk about the constancy of the laws of physics. Now, we're talking constant physics, but a rapidly, continuously expanding universe, that's a universe that gets colder and colder as it gets older and older. And we recognize here are all the fundamental characteristics of Big Bang cosmology. And because Sir Fred Hoyle was very opposed to the Christian faith all of his life, he rejected the Big Bang explanation for the origin and structure of the universe. So I'll share with you tonight some of the compelling reasons why today we must conclude we do indeed live in a Big Bang universe. Now you might ask me, where do you get all this stuff out of the Bible? Well, as I mentioned, most of you are probably quite familiar with the many biblical statements about the beginning of the universe. And when it talks about the beginning of the universe, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and I found that all over the world people know that one verse of the Bible. They may not know anything else, but they know that one verse. And when it talks about the heavens and the earth, this is a compound Hebrew word that means the entire physical universe. What I mean by a compound word is like our English word butterfly. It's got nothing to do with butter or fly. You put the two together, it means something very different. Likewise, there's many literal definitions of the Hebrew word for earth, as well as literal definitions for the Hebrew word for heaven. But when you put the two together, it means only one thing, the entire physical universe. And when it says God created, it uses this word bara in the Hebrew that means to bring into existence something that never existed before. And this is a theme repeated throughout the Bible, and indeed it makes the point that the entire universe, including the space-time dimensions, came into existence by the hand of this creator being beyond space and time. Now, you might ask, what kind of evidence do we have in physics that this statement we see in the Bible in any way is correct? Well, it begins back when I was a graduate student here at the University of Toronto. I was halfway through my studies
when this paper was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of London. And it's titled The Singularities of Gravitational Collapse and Cosmology. And I've argued in a number of my books that this is the most theologically significant theorem ever produced by physicists. Now, what this theorem by Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose claims, states actually, or proves, is that if the universe contains mass, and if the equations of general relativity reliably describe the dynamics of objects within the universe, then there must be an actual beginning to space and time, a beginning to space and time that's coincident with the beginning of the universe. And a corollary to this theorem you'll find in the last couple of pages is that the causal agent that brings this universe into existence does so independent of matter, energy, space, and time. As Hawking himself boasted when he was interviewed by the Reader's Digest, we proved that time was created. But it's a remarkable concession when you recognize that it's the Christian faith, the biblical faith, that makes this claim that time and space were created, that the universe is created. What I see in competing theological systems is this idea that God, gods, or cosmic forces create within an eternally existing space-time realm. The Bible says no, there was no space and time before the universe existed. Now, obviously, we recognize the universe contains mass. If you're a skeptic, we can bring a bathroom scale into the auditorium here. The second assumption of this theorem is not so trivial, that the equations of general relativity reliably describe the dynamics of the universe. And again, I can recall as a graduate student here at the university, when this paper was published, astronomers could only prove the reliability of general relativity to just two places of decimal, to 1% precision. Now that was impressive, but it was not enough to persuade all the skeptics within the astrophysical community. When I went on to Caltech, I met Erwin Shapiro, and at Caltech that he was responsible for pushing it to the third place of the decimal. And by the late 1970s, it was pushed to the fourth place of the decimal confirmation. But there's been huge advances made in the 21st century. To the effect, in the words of Roger Penrose, one of the co-authors of the space-time theorem, today general relativity ranks as the most exhaustively tested principle in all of physics, and the best proven principle in all of physics. In fact, some experiments testing the theory of general relativity have demonstrated that it reliably describes cosmic dynamics to better than 14 places of decimal, to better than a 20% precision. And on that basis alone, I'd be forced to agree with Roger Penrose, this is the best tested and best confirmed principle in all of physics. But this is simply the first of the space-time theorems of general relativity. It's basically in the context of classical general relativity. What has happened in the intervening 36 years is that a number of theoretical physicists have taken the first of these space-time theorems and have generalized them to deal with all reasonable cosmic models. In particular, there's been the attempt to extend this to cover all the quantum gravity creation models that astronomers are speculating. And so to review for you, if the universe contains mass, and if general relativity reliably describes cosmic dynamics, then space and time must be created by a causal agent transcending space and time. And you can check your Webster's Dictionary definition of God. It's reasonably close to what you see up here on the screen. However, there now ranks about 30 different space-time theorems of general relativity. And we see here that the strength of the number of these general relativity proofs are growing experimentally. In fact, right now there's a satellite orbiting planet Earth called the Gravity B Probe, and that's putting general relativity to test in the one arena where we can only verify the two places of decimal, the Lenz-Thurin effect. The Gravity B Probe has the potential to push that to four or five places of a decimal. And so there'll be another opportunity within the next year probably of putting general relativity to an even more rigorous test than it's been put to today. And likewise, the space-time theorems are becoming even more generally applicable than they were in the past. And here's a quote from two theoretical physicists, Ford and Raman, in the Physical Review, quote, all reasonable cosmic models are subject to the relentless grip of the space-time theorems of general relativity.
In a research paper, they were addressing the question, is it possible to conceive of a universe that's not subject to the space-time coherence? And they were able to come up with a number of models of the universe where you don't have to have this beginning of space and time, and a causal agent beyond space and time. But every one of them requires a violation of the second law of thermodynamics, which means it would be a universe where life would simply be impossible. Hence their comment, all reasonable cosmic models, that is a cosmic model that would allow the existence of physical life, must be subject to the relentless grip of the space-time theorems of general relativity. Now what I've reviewed for you here in about 5 minutes is a summary of a longer talk that I've given on this subject in front of audiences made up exclusively of astronomers and physicists. And when I finish the talk, at the start of the question and answer time, I always get this one question, and it's this question. Well, if God created the cosmos, who created God? I mean, what I've simply done is proven that the universe was created by God. What about him? Well, the interesting thing about these space-time theorems, it actually offers a scientific answer to the question, who created God? If you notice what these papers do, is that they establish that there's this causal agent beyond time that is operating through cause and effect. Now, there's quite a few scientists here in the audience. I recognize some of you. And what I would ask you to do, those of you who are not scientists, ask the scientists in this room, in the different disciplines of science, what is the one definition of time that works for all the scientific disciplines and all the properties of time that we observe? Well, it would be that dimension or realm in which cause and effect phenomena take place, where the effects come after the causes. Well, notice that these space-time theorems are telling us that there's cause and effect taking place before cosmic time even exists, which means for this causal agent, that causal agent must have the capacity to move and operate and perform cause and effect operations in a minimum of two independent dimensions of time. Now, if time is geometric rather than linear, that means we can think of time like this sheet of paper, where you'd have a length of time and a width of time. And notice that in a plane of time, you can have as many timelines as you want, even an infinite number of timelines, running in an infinite number of different directions. It'd be possible, for example, to conceive of this causal agent operating a timeline here that's infinitely long, that never crosses or touches the timeline of the universe. As such, that being would have no beginning, would have no ending, and would be uncreated. Now, when I was between 17 and 19, I did a study of the different holy books and religions of the world. And what I noted was the Bible was alone in saying that God can arbitrarily compress time or expand time, and that God is a being that has no beginning, no ending, and is uncreated. Now, to the mathematicians here in the audience, we have recognized that it's only possible to a being who would have access to the minimum of the equivalent of two dimensions of time. So in that sense, we appreciate that the universe must be created, everything in the universe must be created. It's a very simple argument for creation. However, a causal agent that's not confined to linear time would not need to be created. And by the way, I'm not claiming that God is confined to two dimensions of time. What we notice in these space-time theorems, we're dealing with a causal agent that can create space-time dimensions at will. And if you read on in the Bible, it's a being that can remove them at will. So he's not subject to space and time at all, but he's certainly free to operate within. The prophet Jeremiah says God fills the entirety of his creation. While he created 10 space-time dimensions and created this universe, he is operating through cause and effect before the 10 space-time dimensions existed, and he fills the entirety of his creation, then certainly he can be an uncaused causal agent. Now, with reasons to believe, we claim to have a testable creation model that is predictive, capable of successfully predicting future scientific discoveries based on our philosophical paradigm. And so I want to close this part of my talk off with 6 predictions we're making for the future. Number one, we would predict that as scientists learn more about the universe and more about the physics of the universe, that the evidence for a single cosmic beginning will multiply. That evidence that time is finite rather than infinite will grow.
and an evidence for general relativity, reliably describing cosmic dynamics, will be even stronger than it is today. In the case of the gravity D probe, we only have to wait 1 year to see if that prediction bears up. And as a result, the grip of the space-time theorems will become even more relentless than they are today, that the case for a transcendent causal agent will get stronger and stronger, and that evidence for other miraculous acts will be found. Now, I've spent quite a bit of time talking about the causal agent transcending space and time for an important reason. What I hear within the scientific community is this claim that intelligent design research is not science, that there's no room within science for studying the miraculous. But what I've reviewed for you here in the past 10 minutes is a powerful case that at least one miraculous act must have taken place. The universe had a beginning, an actual beginning to space and time. There's a causal agent beyond space and time. What we are confronted here with is an undeniable miracle, the biggest miracle we can imagine, which means that now opens up the possibility that perhaps that causal agent is intervening in other miraculous ways. No longer can we look at the scientific paradigm as one that must be governed by purely natural causes. The door is already open for at least one supernatural intervention, and therefore we need to be at least open-minded to the possibility that there may be others. Now, in saying all that, I want to make it clear that the biblical perspective on this is when we look at the realm of nature, we predominantly see sustaining miracles, this causal agent sustaining the laws of physics to bring about the results that God wants, which means that we scientists will predominantly find in our research natural causes. But the Bible makes clear that it's not just simply the sustaining miracles that God performs to keep things running smoothly through the laws of physics that he sets up, and in addition to that, there are intervention miracles, where God will intervene into the physical order to design things the way he sees fit, but that will happen much more infrequently than the sustaining efforts of the Creator. And least frequently of all will be the transcendent miracles where God intervenes from beyond space and time. So from a Christian perspective, we would find science would be predominantly natural in its causation. To a much smaller degree, we would find evidences for these intervention miracles, and have very few examples of the transcendent miracles. So I started off with a transcendent example. Now, far more frequently than the beginning of the universe, the Bible talks about the continual expansion of the universe. In most English translations, the Hebrew verb natas translated as stretching out of the heavens. But my Hebrew scholar friends have told me that verb natas is actually much better translated, the continual expansion of the universe. And it's actually using a variety of verb forms. One case it uses what's called a cal participle form, which means that God, on an ongoing, continual basis from the creation event forward, is continually expanding his universe. Notice that none of this is in Genesis. You've got to at least get to the book of Job before you find these statements about the expansion of the universe. Sometimes I have to remind my Christian friends, not all creation answers are in the book of Genesis. In Psalms and Isaiah, it makes the point that God stretches out or expands the universe like one would expand a tent in order to live in it. Interesting word picture, because when you think about a tent being stretched out in order to live in it, the reality of that tent is its surface, not its interior or its exterior, but its surface. Likewise, we astronomers now recognize the reality of the universe is the surface of the universe rather than its interior or its exterior. If I could just show you this planet Earth for a minute as an analogy. Three-dimensional object. But where do we human beings live? We live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. Cosmologists now have been able to confirm that in the case of the universe, all the stars and galaxies, all the matter and energy, in fact, even all the space-time dimensions, are confined to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe. So it's just like the tent analogy of Isaiah and the Psalms. Now, by the way, I ignored the six tiny dimensions that accompany the four big dimensions. Now, I'd like to talk about some of the evidences for this continually expanding universe. Now, one point I want to make philosophically is this. No book of philosophy, no book of religion, no book of science talked about the continued expansion of the universe outside of the Bible until Albert Einstein published his general theory of relativity in 1916. That's the first mention or hint we see in the scientific community that we live in a continuously expanding universe. So I look at these verses as one of the more spectacular examples of the Bible thousands of years ahead of its time predicting future scientific discovery. And today we realize there are two factors governing the continual expansion of the universe. There's gravity, which works to slow it down, and there's dark energy, which works to speed it up. But they work in opposite ways. Gravity is most effective when the universe is small. Why? Because that forces the bits and pieces of matter close together. And when the bits and pieces of matter are close together, gravity is more powerful in drawing those pieces of matter together. And so when the universe is young and therefore small, gravity is strong in its capacity to slow down the expansion of the universe. But as the universe gets older and older and bigger, the bits and pieces of matter get farther and farther apart. So gravity becomes progressively weaker in its capacity to slow down the expansion of the universe. Now, dark energy is different. Dark energy is like a gigantic anti-elastic band. And I got one in my briefcase, but I forgot to bring it up here. But just imagine I got a giant elastic band here in front of me. If I were to stretch it, you would notice that the more I stretch an elastic band, the more energy it gains to force the contraction of that elastic band. The surface of the universe is the very opposite. The more you stretch the surface of the universe, the more energy it gains to accelerate the expansion of the universe. And it's the opposite of gravity, that when the universe is young, the surface will be small, and therefore dark energy will be weak in its capacity to accelerate the expansion of the universe. But if the universe gets older and older, it gets bigger and bigger, the surface gets bigger, and the dark energy factor gets stronger and stronger in its capacity to accelerate the universe. Now, until we have the technology to measure the expansion of the universe at great distances, therefore great times back in the past history of the universe, we could only see the gravity effect. We could not see the dark energy term. But now we have the technology to recognize that for the first 8 billion years of its history, the universe was slowing down under the influence of gravity, but for the last 6 billion years, dark energy now dominates the effect of gravity. So for the past 6 billion years, we recognize that we live in an accelerating, expanding universe. However, this dark energy and the mass that governs the slowing down of the expansion of the universe must be very exquisitely fine-tuned in order to bring about the possibility of life in the universe. And Lawrence Krauss, a famous atheist astrophysicist, probably more famous for leading the attack against the intelligent design movement and the creation teaching in the public schools. He wrote a paper in the Astrophysical Journal in which he predicted back in 1998 that astronomers were on the verge of discovering dark energy. And he said when they make this discovery, it will involve the most extreme fine-tuning problem known in physics. Now here's the nature of the problem. If you expand the universe too quickly at different points in its history, then bits and pieces of matter will be pushed apart so rapidly that gravity will not be strong enough to pull any of that stuff together to condense into galaxies, stars, and planets. And if all you have is dispersed gas in the entire history of the universe, there is no possibility for life. Life needs a home. And without galaxies, stars, and planets, there will be no home for life. On the other hand, if you were to expand the universe a little more slowly than what we observe at different points in cosmic history, now gravity is able to very efficiently collect bits and pieces of matter. In fact, it winds up collecting all the matter in the universe and collapsing it into black holes and neutron stars. Now, black holes and neutron stars have a minimum density of 5 billion tons per level teaspoonful. Can you imagine putting that in your coffee? One level teaspoonful, 5 billion tons. The density is so extreme that molecules can't exist. Not even atoms can exist. Matter of fact, not even protons and electrons can exist because of the enormous density. And consequently, life is impossible. And what Lawrence Krauss pointed out in his paper is at the level of fine-tuning. In order to have a universe where you have stars and planets, where life could possibly have a home, any kind of life would possibly have a home, you would have to fine-tune the constant that governs dark energy to better than 1 part in 10 to the 120th, and the constant that governs the master to better than 1 part in 10 to the 60th. Now, that turns out to be 10 to the 97 times superior to the best example I could give you for human engineering design. Now, if you were to put me on the spot, I would say the best example I could give you is a gravity wave telescope that's been designed by Caltech and MIT physicists and funded by the generosity of the U.S. taxpayer. This machine is so incredibly engineered and designed, they can make measurements to 1 part in 10 to the 23. In my opinion, the best machine that humanity has ever built. But notice that it ranks 10 to the 97 times inferior to the level of fine-tuning we see in the dark energy term, which means that this causal agent beyond space and time must be a person. You say, why? Because this causal agent is now proven to be 10 to the 97 times more intelligent and more knowledgeable than those Caltech and MIT physicists. 10 to the 97 times more creative than those Caltech and MIT physicists. And 10 to the 97 times better funded than those Caltech and MIT physicists. Now, if you thought a causal agent manifesting intellect, knowledge, creativity, and power, you have a personal being. And so this is no longer just this ethereal agent transcending space and time. We're talking a personal creator. And I think you can see how we're able to hone in on the definition of this causal agent and what that means philosophically and theologically. And keep in mind, this quote here about this problem did come from one of the leading atheist scholars here in the country. And of course, he would refer to it as a problem, given the implications of that fine-tuning. But I've got another paper here in front of me, written by three other famous theoretical physicists, two from Stanford and one from MIT, Dyson, Kleben, and Susskind. And the title of their paper is Disturbing Implications of a Cosmological Constant. Cosmological constant is another term for dark energy. And what they state in their paper, I'm going to pull up a couple of quotes for you. Arranging the universe as we think it is arranged would have required a miracle. Now that's a remarkable statement for three atheist physicists to state in a research paper. Arranging the universe as we think it is arranged, that is with dark energy, would have required a miracle. And here's the second statement. An external agent, mainly external to space and time, intervened for cosmic history for reasons of its own. Now as atheists, they found this conclusion of this agent beyond space and time performing miracles for reasons of his own to be so extremely disturbing that they concluded their paper with this sentence. This is the final sentence in the paper. The only reasonable conclusion is we do not live in a world, that is a universe, with a true cosmological constant. In other words, they claim dark energy must be wrong. So the dark energy is right. We're stuck with this external agent performing miracles for reasons of his own. Now, these statements I pulled out of the preprint that was posted on the Los Alamos website of theoretical physics papers that are due for publication. The irony of the posting of this paper is it went up on the Los Alamos website just weeks before astronomers proved in an undeniable way that dark energy is real. Here, and this is all posted on our reasons.org website. We'll actually give you on our website links to the research papers that show these confirmations of dark energy. I'm not going to go into the details of this because of the lack of time, but you'll see that we have extensive discussions on this on our website. But the X-ray emission from clusters of galaxies proves the existence of dark energy, as does the maps of the radiation left over from the creation event, what we call the cosmic background radiation, both from the WMAP satellite and ground-based measurements. We use supernova and gravitational lenses to measure the expansion universe at different points in cosmic history. They, too, testify to dark energy. And then we have surveys of clusters of galaxies that do the same thing. All nine of these observational confirmations not only tell us that dark energy exists, they tell us that dark energy is the dominant component of the universe. It makes up 73% of all the stuff in the universe. And several of these measuring techniques are able to measure the quantity of dark energy to just 2 or 3% precision. Bottom line, dark energy is not going away. We really are stuck with this causal agent beyond space and time, performing miracles for reasons of his own. Now, we're not just talking an argument based on dark energy. As I mentioned, the mass of the universe also must be fine-tuned. And here again, we see extraordinary fine-tuning. Now, this universe in which we live, we can observe 50 billion trillion stars. And we astronomers know that that total quantity of 50 billion trillion stars only makes up 1% of the mass of the observable universe. And yet, in order to get a universe where you have the appropriate bodies where life would be possible, it's such that if we were to add a single dime's worth of mass to those 50 billion trillion stars, where they make up just 1% of the total mass of the universe, add one dime to the universe, or subtract one dime from the universe, there would be no place for physical life to exist anytime, anywhere in the universe. A dime is enough to make a difference. And we see this throughout physics. It's not just two characteristics. We see many characteristics of the universe that must be exquisitely fine-tuned to make life possible. All four of the fundamental forces of physics must be exquisitely fine-tuned. To give you one example, in order for stars to burn in a stable fashion, a critical requirement for life, you don't want stars that are immediately exploding, and you don't want stars that won't ever form at all. And to have stable burning stars, it's necessary that the force of electromagnetism relative to the force of gravity be fine-tuned to within one part in 10,000 trillion trillion trillion. If it's not fine-tuned to that degree, no possibility for stable burning stars. And the list goes on. As a matter of fact, if you go to our reasons.org website, you'll see posted there a list of 93 different characteristics of the universe and the laws of physics that must be extraordinarily fine-tuned to make life possible. You'll also notice that we have on our website a list of those characteristics over the past 5 years. And what you notice there, the more we learn about physics and the more we learn about the universe, the more evidence we find for the supernatural, superintelligent design. And I'm confident the year 2007 we'll be able to push the list past 100 different design characteristics for the universe. Now, we're talking about the universe at large. The universe at large is very difficult for us astronomers to measure in any great detail. But we are able to measure subcomponents of the universe with much more accuracy. And when we do that, we discover what we call a heavenly body problem that not any ordinary galaxy will do. As a matter of fact, I can go one step up. You need a very special galaxy cluster for life to be possible, a very special galaxy, a very special star, a special component of planets. It turns out that all 8 of the planets in our solar system must be critically fine-tuned to make life possible on our planet Earth. When we look at the Earth itself, we see hundreds of different characteristics that must be fine-tuned to make life possible. Even the Moon must be fine-tuned to make life possible. Now, I break this out in some detail for you, but I know we got going a little bit late today, so I'm going to kind of skip through this. This is covered in a number of my books, especially The Crater and the Cosmos, which lists and describes all the characteristics of the galaxy that must be fine-tuned, the solar system, the Earth. And if you want to not read the book, we have a television documentary for those of you who don't want to read. You can watch all this stuff, how extraordinarily designed the universe is. In fact, what I'd like to do for you here is I'll just show you a quick video clip from our television documentary and what I call the weakest of our arguments for supernatural design in the universe. And that would be the Moon. The best evidence would be the galaxy, our solar system, planet Earth, the cluster of galaxies. But even with the Moon, we see extraordinary evidence for supernatural design. So what I'm going to do, I think I can just take this thing off here and you can hear the sound. So, whoops.
back here.
That's not going to help. Here we go.
Exploration enabled us to confirm that lunar rocks differ chemically from Earth rocks. Through study of lunar rocks' radioactive decay, researchers discovered that the moon is in fact nearly 100 million years younger than the Earth. In the 1990s, a theory explaining the moon's existence gained wide acceptance in the scientific community. According to this theory, an object the size of Mars crashed into the newly forming Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. Most of the object's mass was absorbed by the Earth, but this collision also sent up a huge cloud of dust and rocky fragments all around the Earth. In time, gravity pulled those fragments together into one solid body, the moon. The Earth, meanwhile, lost its entire atmosphere, and a new, much thinner one began to form from gases released by Earth's crustal material. Such a collision may seem a disaster, but it proved just the opposite. It set in motion certain alterations to Earth's features that eventually made this planet a uniquely suitable site for life. The odds against a collision benefiting the eventual support of human life are staggering. The planet colliding with the Earth would need to be at the right size, moving at the right velocity, striking at the right angle, made of the right materials, and occurring at the right time in the development of planet Earth. If any one of these factors were off by just a few percent, the Earth would be barren today. Unless that impact had occurred, Earth's atmosphere would be much heavier than it is, even heavier than that of our neighboring planet, Venus. Venus's thick carbon dioxide-filled atmosphere would mean instant death for all possible life. The extra mass Earth gained from the collision, along with its atmospheric revision, meant that water could exist on Earth in all three states: ice, liquid, and vapor.
Thank you. We have the lights back on. That was produced in 2004. What has happened in the intervening time is the scientists have been able to discover 30 independent characteristics of the moon that must be extraordinarily fine-tuned to make advanced life possible on a planet. One, for example, is the fact that we have this small planet orbited by a single gigantic moon stabilizes the tilt of Earth's rotation axis at 23.5 degrees. Now, the other planets in our solar system have axial tilts that bounce back and forth over the history of the solar system. Earth is unique, and it has a stable rotation axis tilt, a critical requirement for advanced life. And just a few months ago, a British astrophysicist, Waltham, published a paper in Astrobiology. It's in my briefcase. I meant to have it up here for you to look at. But he published a paper where he pointed out that when we look at the Earth-Moon system, the moon seems to be at the hairy edge of sending the axial tilt unstable. And in fact, if the moon were just 1% more massive than what it was, we would not have a stable rotation axis tilt. And so we ask the question, is there something we are missing in the Earth-Moon dynamical system that explains why the moon is so at the extreme edge of providing stability to the rotation axis tilt? And his point is that you have a much more stable axial tilt in terms of its longevity than the moon is about half of its mass. But it's at this extreme upper limit. And so he dug into this, and what he discovered is that this moon-forming collision event, where this Mars-sized body collides with the Earth and forms the moon, that collision event sends the planet spinning at about 2 hours per day. And what we've observed in looking at things like coral reefs is that indeed we can document that over geologic history, the Earth has been slowing down in its rotation rate.
And the physicists here in the audience will tell you that because of the enormous mass of the moon and its proximity, that works as a strong tidal break on the rotation of the Earth's axis. In fact, we can observe that it slows down by a few microseconds per year. Well, what Waltham discovered is there's no way the planet would be rotating slow enough for advanced life in just 4.5 billion years after this moon-forming event, unless the moon was at the extreme upper limit of a mass which would provide stability to the tilt of the Earth's rotation axis. In other words, there's this narrow window of time in which human beings could live here on planet Earth. It's when the planet is 4.5662 billion years. And if you miss that window of time, there's no possibility for human life. And one of the requirements for advanced human civilization is a rotation rate of 24 hours a day. So it's critical from the Creator's perspective that we get the planet to slow down fast enough that when you reach that 4.5662 billion years, it's got a 24-hour rotation rate. So this is another example we have of a fine-tuning design of the moon for the benefit of life. Now, I spent some time talking about the moon because it allows us to exemplify a rather elegant test for whether or not creation explains the universe or some naturalistic explanation. Let me put it from a naturalistic perspective. Let's assume there's no transcendent supernatural creator. And the more we learn about the universe, the more we would discover that what we thought was evidence for supernatural design would gradually go away. The evidence would become progressively weaker as we learn more and more about the universe. However, if there is a creator, then the more we learn about the universe, the more evidence we'll see for the supernatural intervention of this creator for the benefit of life and human beings in particular. Now, just as we post this evidence on the universe, we also post it on our Milky Way galaxy and the solar system. And we actually give you about a 5-year running record of how the evidence has been accumulated. Now, here's our posting for May of 2002. By May of 2002, in going through the scientific literature, we found 202 different characteristics of our Milky Way galaxy and our solar system that must be fine-tuned to make advanced life possible here on planet Earth. And you adjust for the dependency factors and the maximum number of planets that any astronomers conceive of the universe containing, namely 10 billion trillion, that leaves you with one chance in 10 to the 217 of finding one body anywhere in the universe with the capacity to support physical life, advanced physical life, apart from miraculous intervention. Now, let's jump forward 30 months to November of 2004. What we notice is now we're dealing with 437 characteristics, not just 202. And now the probability is less than one chance in 10 to the 410. Now, to put that in layman's language, that's roughly equivalent to the probability of anyone in this room winning, I don't know what the Ontario lottery is like, because I don't know what the odds are, but I do know the odds of the California lottery, which I think are much more remote than the odds of you winning the Ontario lottery. The odds of you winning the California lottery. One chance in 10 to the 410 is a more remote possibility than your chance of winning the California lottery 50 consecutive times where you buy just one ticket each time. Or really not significantly different from winning the California lottery 50 consecutive times where you don't buy any tickets at all. Or the probability is indistinguishable from zero. But what I want you to notice especially is the difference 30 months of research makes. In those 30 months, conservatively, what we notice is that the evidence for a transcendent creator beyond space and time, manifesting the attributes of creativity, power, intelligence, and intellect, far beyond what we human beings can manifest, namely the God of the Bible, we see that that evidence, just in these two narrow disciplines of astrophysics, gets a million times stronger every single month. In other words, we can share with the skeptics, if you're not convinced today, wait 30 days. 30 days, the evidence, based on what we've seen in the past, will be a million times stronger than it is today. But we're in the business of updating this list, and I can confidently tell you it is continuing to get a million times stronger per month. Now, the quote just from one individual that does not share my physical or theological perspective, Paul Davies is an agnostic astrophysicist, but he wrote a book called The Cosmic Blueprint, in which he said, simply looking at the design characteristics of the universe, never mind the galaxy, or the solar system, or planet Earth or the moon, just the universe, it seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers, especially for the benefit of the human species. And the impression of design is overwhelming. It's far more overwhelming today than it was when Paul Davies wrote it. And one of my favorite quotes comes from a professor I had here at the University of Toronto many years ago, Jeffrey Burbidge. And Jeffrey has been an outspoken atheist all of his life. But there was a time when astronomers were able to confirm an important prediction of Big Bang cosmology. And Jeffrey Burbidge has always been bitterly opposed to Big Bang cosmology because of its Christian implications. But when this discovery was made, he complained that his peer astronomers were rushing off to join the First Church of Christ at the Big Bang. And this was picked up by the Toronto Globe and Mail. He made the comment when he was here in Toronto, and I quickly called him on the phone and said, well, you know, Jeffrey, I'm coming from a Christian perspective on this. Can I quote you? He said, sure, you can quote me. So I'm using his quote to end my book. Now, I want to spend the rest of the time dealing with how do astronomers and physicists who don't share my Christian perspective respond to this kind of evidence? There's only three responses. I'm going to just share briefly what those three responses are. Response number one was published in the best-selling science book of all time, Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time. I now hear it has sold over 17 million copies. Some have commented it's the best sold unread book. But nevertheless, it is the best-selling science book. And what he says in that book is that, yes, there is some kind of creator out there. He says the evidence for God just in the mathematics is overwhelming. Now, he's not a Christian, but he does claim to be a believer in God. But he says it can't be the Christian God because, he says, the Christian God would not make so many useless stars and galaxies. And his point is this. If God wanted a place for human beings to live, all he has to do is make one planet. We're going to need the moon. We're going to need Jupiter. And oh, yes, we need the other seven planets in their positions and masses and orbits. We need the sun, but we really don't need anything else. And he says, when I look at the Bible, and Stephen Hawking actually knows quite a bit about the Bible. He was married to a Christian for a number of years. And he says, what I know about the Bible is it's a God that doesn't waste miracles. Now, I would have to agree that Stephen Hawking is right. I get the same conclusion when I read the Bible. This is a God that never performs any more miracles than are necessary. And he says, on that basis, it can't be the God of the Bible. Now, what he overlooks in his book is that the total mass of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned to get the universe to expand at the just right rate. Well, that wasn't fully appreciated until after he published his book, but one thing that was appreciated in his time is this. Is if you make the universe slightly less massive than what we observe, then nuclear physics will not be so efficient in the Big Bang creation event. And instead of the universe making 25% helium out of the hydrogen at that time, it'll make much less. And if it makes any less, you wind up with a universe with no elements heavier than helium. And in that universe, life would be forever impossible. Now, if you make the universe slightly more massive than what we observe, then in the Big Bang creation event, much more of the hydrogen is converted into helium, which means that today we'd be living in a universe where everything is elements heavier than helium. There would be no hydrogen, and you can't make life without hydrogen. Hydrogen is a fundamental requirement for life. In order to get the universe where you have all the elements necessary for building advanced life, it's critical that the universe be exactly the mass that we observe. So it's really not counter to the Christian God to make so many stars and galaxies. Rebuttal number two. We would not be here unless the universe had the attributes we observe. My colleague previous to me brought this point up in his talk. And this is a case where you've got physicists making statements about philosophy when they think they're making statements about physics. And we have a philosopher full-time on our reasons to believe research staff. I mean, we've got all those scientists, but we've got a philosopher. And we kid our philosopher, Ken Samples, by saying, the only purpose philosophers ever serve in this universe is to help you win arguments against other philosophers. Everything else they do is useless. On the other hand, I consider that to be such a valuable function, we pay him a goodly salary to be our research staff. And Ken Samples served the purpose of exposing the philosophies of physicists and mathematicians and astronomers. But he doesn't get credit for this one. It goes to the British philosopher, Richard Swinburne. And what Richard Swinburne did is he came up with an analogy to expose the fallacy in his comment, we wouldn't be here unless the universe had all these precisely fine-tuned attributes we observed. What he came up with was, well, this might work in this audience. I imagine this being Ontario, quite a few of you enjoy going hunting during hunting season. Therefore, we could go throughout the audience here and pick out the 10 best sharpshooters in the audience. And we could stand them here in the front row, give them high-powered rifles with telescopic sights, and then we would get a volunteer from the audience, say this young man, and he would stand up right here behind me. Then I would instruct these 10 sharpshooters to aim their rifles at his heart and pull the trigger. Now, what happens in the course is he stands here and he survives the event. And he looks up at all of you and says, of course, I wouldn't be here unless they all missed. Well, Richard Swinburne's point is that not what would come out of his mouth if he had survived that event. Rather, what would come out of his mouth is a comment, why did they miss? It makes no rational sense that they would miss if they purposed that I would die. Therefore, someone must have purposed that I would be alive. Likewise, Richard Swinburne says, philosophically, the only rational conclusion to the universe having all of these fine-tuned characteristics, there must be somebody behind the universe that purposed that we human beings would be alive. In the same manner that this individual could only explain the occurrence if these 10 individuals all purposely aimed their rifle away from his heart or somebody put blanks in all of their guns. Somebody must have purposed that he would survive the event. However, this is not the most popular rebuttal today. And by the way, this rebuttal was very popular 15 years ago. But thanks to Richard Swinburne, it's virtually gone away. But the most popular rebuttal today is the multiverse. That we live in a universe, but maybe there are more universes. What if there's an infinite number of universes where they all have different physical characteristics? And if they all have different physical characteristics, and if there's truly an infinite number of them, then we could argue our universe has all these amazingly fine-tuned characteristics by pure chance. Now, I've argued in my book, The Creator of the Cosmos, that this is simply a form of a gambler's fallacy. And to help illustrate that gambler's fallacy, I'm going to put the coin here. Okay, it's a Canadian quarter, one of those old ones, so it's got heads on one side and loose on the other. Okay? And this came up loose. What if I were to put this coin 100,000 times and it came up loose all 100,000 times? How many of you would be willing to bet heads on the next flip of the coin? Now, if you're committing the gambler's fallacy, you'd be quite eager to bet heads on the next flip. And you'd be rationalizing as follows. Well, Dr. Ross, this isn't the only quarter that exists in the universe. There are other quarters. What if there is an infinite number of quarters, all being flipped by people 100,000 consecutive times each? The laws of probability tell us that one of those coins will produce 100,000 consecutive heads. And therefore, I'm going to bet that the universe is here by pure chance rather than here by the purposeful action of a creator beyond space and time. Now, in the case of the coin, we call it the gambler's fallacy because we have no evidence. Well, I can pull it up my coin. There we go. Here we go, back to the corner. We have no evidence for 10 to the 100,000 quarters anywhere in the universe. It's a much more limited number than that. We have no evidence that 10 to the 100,000 people are flipping these coins 100,000 consecutive times.
and we especially have no evidence that they're all producing different results. Our response for the multiverse astrophysicist is, who says all universes have to be distinct? You know, maybe you could have an infinite number of universes where they're all identical. Then where does the argument go? Or maybe half of them are identical and the rest aren't. Then what do you do? However, what I've recognized with my astronomy peers is they'll respond as follows. While we appreciate that we really are committing the gambler's fallacy, however, because this God of yours is making such high demands on our personal lives, actually wants us to shape up our moral behavior, we demand way more evidence for that than we do for other events. Well, I can appreciate that. I personally went through that struggle. I didn't meet Christians until I was 27. It was the Gideon Bible that brought me to faith in Christ. And I can tell you, going through that Gideon Bible, I went through the same struggle, saying, okay, this God is making serious demands of my life, and I'm looking for serious evidence before I make a commitment. But what I would say to people committing the gambler's fallacy, if you see a coin being flipped 100,000 consecutive times, and it comes up moose all 100,000 times, wouldn't you like to look at both sides of the coin before you make your next guess? Wouldn't you like to make measurements on this coin to see if it's been weighted to always come up moose instead of heads? Well, again, when I give this talk in front of astronomers, they say, well, we can't do that with the universe. I say, yes, we can. Here's how we can do it with the universe. We've made a lot of research on the universe, but no astronomer will tell you we know everything about the universe. What we can do is continue our research on the universe for another few months. And in my discipline of astronomy, the knowledge base about the universe doubles every 4 years. So we learn a lot in a hurry. What we can do is wait, say, two of those 4 years, and in looking at those 2 years of worth of scientific research, we see greater evidence for supernatural design rather than lesser evidence. Isn't that really equivalent to proving there's moose on both sides of the coin? And therefore, you can save your bet. You don't have to bet on the gambler's fallacy. You can put this to the test. And that's really the message I want to leave with you tonight. Namely, that in these faith science issues, these creation evolution issues, everything can be put to the test. And I didn't say it first. It was the Apostle Paul in 1 Thessalonians 5:21 who said, everything must be tested. Hold fast to that which is good. And that's the appeal we leave with you in my book, The Creator and the Cosmos, which goes into this subject in far more detail than I had a chance to share tonight. And again, if you don't like to read, there's our DVD, Journey Towards Creation. Won several awards, by the way, and we just released it in a 12-language edition. And we're going to segue into a question and answer time here, but I want to leave this with you. If you have to run off or you don't get a chance to ask your question tonight, every day except Christmas, we answer your questions on these creation evolution issues. So feel free to call us and feel free to join us for our 2-hour weekly webcast on the latest scientific discoveries that put creation evolution models to the test. It's live, and you're welcome to call in with your questions. We also make available to you a free magazine. Let me see if I got it. Here it is. It's called Connections. We offer a free subscription to this magazine for anyone who asks. Thank you very much.
Are going to be here for a few minutes. Some of you have to go, that's okay, we understand. These questions that we ask can be fielded by either or both of our in-house speakers tonight. And your questions can take on three different forms. On one hand, the question can be the hostile type. Okay, and you gentlemen are not afraid of those, right? The other kind can be the ones that squeal with delight. And then the other question kind that might be just simply, what did you mean by dark energy? Or when you were talking about the molecules, please tell us what that meant, Dr. Mitchell. So, I'll field your question. I'll connect to you with the mic, and each gentleman has a microphone here. David, one comment while you're thinking of your question, and that is, if you'd like to come back tomorrow and not have to pay the $20 fee, come and see me, and I'll give you this pass. Okay? If you're on your way of asking for this pass. Tomorrow, we're going to have a full day from 9 to 4 with panels, lectures. You're going to be doing another presentation or two. And we're going to have panels with people from the full side and the full spectrum. The other thing I want to say is that if you'd like to contribute to offset some of the costs, there is a blue box in the hallway, and you can just drop in your donation there towards St. Mike's, and that will offset the cost of operating this conference. So now your questions. Oh, also one other thing. If you want to know about is there life in outer space, Dr. Ross will be in Richmond Hill tomorrow night. So there'll be a presentation at 7:30. Speak to me about that. Now your questions. I'll come to you. Just raise your hand. Okay, here's one.
Dr. Ross, how would you explain the fine-tuning that's going on with regards to climate change?
Fine-tuning with regards to climate change? There's been fine-tuning regards to climate change for the past 3.8 billion years. Our book, Origins of Life, talks about the evidence for God creating life 3.8 billion years ago. And what you see in our latest book, Creation of Science, is that in order to deal with the changes in the sun, it's critical that you create just the right life forms at just the right time and bring certain life forms into extinction. Now, what you'll see in our latest book is we give you a chart of what's been happening to the sun over the past 4 billion years. First of all, when the sun was young, it was losing mass at a pretty rapid rate, and hence it dimmed by 15%. The luminosity of stars goes up with a fourth power of their mass. However, as the sun continued to convert hydrogen into helium through thermonuclear reactions, that increased the density of the core of the sun, which means that that thermonuclear furnace burns hotter and hotter as the sun gets older and older. And so the sun today is 15% brighter than it was 3 billion years ago. Now, light can only tolerate a 1% change in the luminosity of the sun. And how the Creator has been compensating for that is to create just the right life forms at just the right time and just the right diversity and abundance, that those life forms will adjust the greenhouse effect of Earth's atmosphere. So in the early part of Earth's history, it was enhancing the greenhouse effect to make the surface of the planet Earth warm enough to take into account that the sun was getting dimmer and its brightness. And for the last 3 billion years, we have the Creator introducing species in a particular sequence, so that those species would weaken the greenhouse effect. And so the greenhouse effect in Earth's atmosphere today is much weaker than it was billions of years ago. The net result is the temperature on the surface of planet Earth has been kept benign for all variety of life throughout the entire 3.8 billion years. Now, a biblical reference to this is Psalm 104, where it tells us it's the property of all life to die off, but God recreates. What we see the Creator doing is that He removes life forms from the planet, and He does that wholesale. They're called mass extinction events, where God will engineer events in the history of the solar system where things like supernova will explode close to the Earth, or a giant asteroid or comet collides with the Earth, and the net effect of that is it brings into extinction anywhere from, say, 35% to 95% of all the species of life on planet Earth. What that does is remove species from the planet that are no longer appropriate to compensate for the changes in the physics of the sun, and replaces them with new species of life that are going to be able to perfectly compensate for that changed physics. And that's really the explanation for why the fossil record looks the way it does. You know, the naturalist looks at it and sees this progression of simple life to complex life. But as a creationist, I look at all that and I see there's a reason for the order of the sequence of life we see here on planet Earth. And I can't attribute to natural cause if for no other reason. What I notice is, in many cases, we can document that mass speciation events
follow mass extinction events in less than 10,000 years. I'll give you one dramatic example. The Triassic dinosaurs were on the face of the Earth, and there was five big asteroid collisions that hit across the United States and Canada. And it wiped out 60% of all the life forms on planet Earth and brought into extinction all the large body creatures, not just the dinosaurs. But they were totally wiped out. And yet we can see in our core drill that we have the appearance of the Jurassic dinosaurs with an intact, optimized ecology less than 10,000 years after the Triassic dinosaurs were wiped out. Now, from a naturalistic explanation, there's no way that naturalistic process can produce those kinds of dramatic changes that quickly, especially when you recognize that the bigger the animal in terms of its body size, the lower the probability for evolutionary advance from a naturalistic Darwinian perspective. Now, I can give you more than one example of that. The Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary also can prove to be less than 10,000 years. But again, Psalm 104, it's the property of life to die off that God recreates. He recreates in such a way that you keep planet Earth optimally abundant with life. I mean, what's amazing to me is that this planet, for 3.8 billion years, has always carried the maximum biomass as possible under the laws of physics. And we today, 3.8 billion years later, are the beneficiaries of the Creator packing the planet with so much life for so long. That's why we got all those tar sands in Alberta. That's why we have all these ores of silver and the zinc and the lead all over the Canadian Northland. That's all there because billions of species of life preceded us for billions of years, and we're the beneficiaries of all that life that preceded us. There's a reason why God creates human beings last of all.
Okay, next question.
When would the human species wiped out?
When will the human species be wiped out? Well, that's an argument I'm going to talk about tomorrow. And I'm not the only one saying this. There are a number of leading atheist astrophysicists who are concluding that the maximum time in which humans can live in a global civilized state has got to be less than 41,000 years. Now, I talked tonight about what's called the entropic principle, all these design characteristics of the galaxy and the solar system that must be fine-tuned to make our existence possible. Many of those characteristics are highly variable. And because of their high variability, that leaves you with an extremely narrow window of time in which humans can exist in a civilized state. Now, the window of time for human beings that are not global, low population, with no technology beyond Stone Age technology, that's about 100,000 years wide. So you're talking organized global civilization, 41,000 years only. Which I guess draws the next question, how much more time do we have? Well, we've had civilization at that level for only the past 10,000 years. So it means we've got 31,000 years to go. But if you want some bad news, we think that these British astrophysicists that developed these calculations were too optimistic. Our own calculations show that the window of time is probably more like 20,000 years and will get shorter if our technology becomes much more advanced. The interesting thing is this. Genetic decay in the human species is directly proportional to the level of our technology. The higher the technology, the more rapid the genetic decay in our species. And there's one research paper where they've actually made measurements on the U.S. population. And this is in the year 2000. And the year 2000, there was three deleterious mutations being propagated per American citizen per generation. Now, if you extrapolate that out 1,000 years, that means there'll be no Americans living in the United States. But if you extrapolate that worldwide, you get an extinction time in just a few thousand years. However,
you've got to have an element of faith coming in. This pessimistic story is bothering me. If there was a moment in time when everything was finally proved, I mean, if what I'm arguing about is perfect, I've got to say this is a wonderful beginning. If a wonderful beginning is purposeful, it's going somewhere. And my question is, this is where the science-based debate has to shift a little bit. We can get bogged down with the numbers, But we've got to ask this other question, you see, this purpose question, and that's where my optimism comes from. In fact, before I go home tonight, I'm going to show an experiment just to hammer home the fact that we've got to put this story of God's word with the works. And I'm a little bit inclined to think of it in a broader brush picture for that. Because I said, don't look at just the raindrop, but look through the window to the light.
Well, actually, what I'm doing here tonight is telling you the bad news with a plug for my talk tomorrow. Exactly what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. And there's some really good news in the fact that we've only got 30,000 of these left. Come tomorrow, and I'll tell you all about it.
Listen, folks, you've got to apply this to reality. I want to give you a little parable before you go. I'm going to be tired. And I know you've got questions, but you're going to want. This is a throwaway bottle. It should go in the garbage can. But I'm doing my last bit of chemical reaction. This is going to work slow tonight. Oh, rather a bad night. But this is a black picture that's just been presented, and I got a black solution. But by the time I finish this reaction, this will be coated with pure silver. And you know enough about chemistry to know that some metals like potassium, they react, and you've seen that tonight, but silver doesn't react. That's why we make coins out of it. And what I'm trying to make here, and it's going slower because it's cold, is a family heirloom. Because this bottle is going to reflect the light of this room. And I'm going to be able to see myself in it very shortly. You can already see that a mirror is forming. And I think, in spite of all we said tonight, you and I have said a lot about fine-tuned molecules and a fine-tuned universe. I still go back to that great theologian. Paul said, now we see through a glass darkly. And then he finishes that with an optimistic quote. And I can't see my face, and again, it's gone awful slow, but you can begin to see this. This thing, I can pass to my children and grandchildren. And I've got to say that this fine-tuned beginning, this exquisitely orchestrated universe, this synchronized system has got to be going somewhere. And that's where you need to do a faith exploration. I don't want to just leave it. You see, the implications of a creative act for me is that there aren't any ordinary persons. You know, that every individual is special. And that the end of the story is where we have to look, and that's where the faith perspective comes in. It's not very shiny silver bottle, but it will get there. And it just gives an optimistic end to a wonderful evening. Thing.
Thank you.